Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. Now, before we get into the very last regularly scheduled episode of Season 3, we have a small ask for you that will make a big impact for Dennis Perry and other clients of the Georgia Innocence Project. Please, right now, text the word Dennis to 91999 and donate even $5 to help GIP fight for Dennis's freedom. Right now, you can text Dennis to 91999 and donate any amount you could give to support the Georgia Innocence Project to help fight for Dennis and so many others like him. Once again, text Dennis to 91999.
The first time we asked undisclosed listeners to support GIP's work was just over 2 years ago, when Joey Watkins' story on Season 2 was wrapping up. GIP was such a shoestring operation then, with a tiny budget, struggling to raise just barely enough money to hire a staff attorney. And now, only 2 years later, thanks in huge part to the profound dedication and generosity of undisclosed listeners, we've hired not only one, but two staff attorneys. I tell everyone, and I'm delighted to say it now directly to you, undisclosed listeners saved GIP. We are so deeply grateful for your support.
And while the Georgia Innocence Project's capacity to help innocent people in prison is only growing stronger, there's still so much work to be done. You've now heard the stories of just two GIP clients, Joey Watkins and Dennis Perry, told over 45 episodes and almost as many addenda. Think of how dense and complicated these cases are. And now think about the fact that GIP has 88 other cases in investigation and litigation stages, with 240 application stage cases and more coming in every day. 88 other late stage cases. GIP still very much needs your help.
When you text the word Dennis to 91999 and donate even $5 or $10, you'll help us continue to work behind the scenes once the podcast ends to fight for justice and freedom for Dennis, Joey, and so many others. We'll stay connected with you and keep you updated on their cases and others. As we've seen so clearly over the past 2 years, when a large group of dedicated people give what they can, even if only $5, it makes a huge transformative impact on our ability to represent the imprisoned innocent. And for those who supported us recently, thank you, thank you, thank you.
So if you have been moved by Dennis's case, before you listen to this final episode of Season 3, pick up your phones and text the word Dennis to 91999. You'll get a link right back where you can donate in any amount, however small, to help the Georgia Innocence Project continue fighting for Dennis and Joey and the many, many other people in prison in Georgia and Alabama for crimes they did not commit. Donnie Barentine became a suspect in this case on July 15, 1985, when his friend Jeff Kittrell told investigators that Barentine had confessed to him to being involved in the murders at Rising Daughter. Barentine wasn't the shooter, Kittrell claimed, but he'd gone to the church that night with a blonde-haired, cold-blooded friend. Barentine had waited outside, Kittrell said, while his friend had gone inside, where he shot and killed Harold and Thelma Swain. There have been many attempts over the years to figure out the identity of the friend that Jeff Kittrell told investigators about, but they've all failed. That's assuming, of course, this friend ever existed in the first place. Jeff Kittrell was hardly the most credible witness himself. Plenty of things he claimed about the Swain case over the years have turned out not to be true. But if Kittrell's story about the blonde-haired, cold-blooded friend has any truth to it, there's one person still around who'd know the man's identity.
Excuse me. Do you know I can find...
That's why earlier this year, Susan found herself driving around on some back roads in Florida that weren't very well marked, hoping to find people out on porches who might be able to give some directions.
What's the name? Barentine? Yeah. Is that the right place? Do you know if it's over there or... And you don't know the name Barentine at all?
Is the lady a teacher? What's the little boy's name?
They don't have a kid that I know of.
Do they own chickens?
They do own chickens.
Oh, so the chicken man.
Yeah.
Donnie Barentine has historically not been particularly cooperative with investigators looking into this case, and there were no guarantees he'd be willing to talk about it now. But there were lots of questions about the case, and about the 33-year-long investigation that Donnie Barentine is probably the only person with the answers to who is still around today. So, it was worth a try anyway.
The chicken man?
Yeah, I don't know him as anything
really?
Else. You keep going.
Uh-huh.
We right here with this road.
Uh-huh.
Keep going all the way around. And then you go to, like, a state road.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is the final episode in our series of The State versus Dennis Perry. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
As instructed, I kept heading down the bumpy hilly road until eventually I came across some chickens and figured this must be the place. When I knocked on the door, Barentine's wife answered, and when I told her why I was there, she said Donnie was out working in the yard, but if I wanted to wait, he should be in soon. Inside, the Barentines had a pack of rescue dogs of every shape and size and a very pudgy tabby cat who decided that the whole time I was there, I was going to have to keep petting him or else he'd fuss. And while I waited, I chatted with Donnie Barentine's wife, who was busy making dinner. She told me that she and Donnie hadn't met until the 90s, long after all this mess that I was here about, but she knew a little about it. She'd even read the transcript, she said, or at least the parts that had Donnie in it. She'd seen the Unsolved Mysteries show, too. As far as she knew, she said, the only thing they had on Donnie was that someone had identified his boots. But she knew the DNA at the crime scene hadn't been his, and she thought he'd been at work on the day of the murders anyway. There'd been a time card to prove it. A few minutes later, Donnie Barentine came in. When I told him why I wanted to talk to him, I can't say he was exactly thrilled about it, but he wasn't unfriendly. And he agreed to talk to me about what he knew, although, probably not surprising, he didn't want to be recorded.
When Susan spoke to Donnie Barentine, it was hardly the first time someone had questioned him about the Swain case. Over the past 33 years, Donnie Barentine has been interviewed about the Swain case dozens of times, off and on. At least a few of these interviews were recorded, but today, almost all those recordings have been lost. There's only one that still exists.
What's the date? The 22nd day?
Yes.
Today is February 22nd, 2002. And the time is approximately 15:45. We're at the Wayne County District Attorney's Office.
After Dennis Perry's attorneys had made it clear that their defense at trial would be to try to blame Donnie Barentine for the murders, the state decided it needed to interview Donnie Barentine again. After a bit of coaxing, they convinced Barentine to drive up to John Johnson's office in Jessup, Georgia, where he was given an immunity agreement to sign and then brought into a conference room to be interviewed. Though most interviews were recorded on audio cassette or not recorded at all, for some reason this interview was videotaped. When the grainy video footage begins, you can see Donnie Barentine and three investigators gathered around a conference room table in the DA's office. Barentine is at the far end of the table, leaning back comfortably in his chair. Dale Bundy is closest to the camera. He pulls out a pocket watch to check the time and start the interview, and then begins taking notes. Which is kind of interesting, given that Bundy has also claimed the reason there are no notes from him in this case file is because he doesn't take notes during interviews, at least not when GBI agents are present. And there's a GBI agent there. a guy named Mike Troll, who is relatively new to the case. He'd been brought in a few months before to replace the previous GBI investigator, Agent Ron Rhodes, when he left to join the ATF. And mostly out of frame, there's also a DA's investigator, Vicky Moore, though she doesn't say much.
A lot of what Donnie Barentine said during this interview at John Johnson's office matched up almost exactly with what he told me when I spoke to him down in Florida.
Do you know of anyone who was involved in this, or who you would think would have been involved in this? Anyone who had already killed Harold and Donald Swain?
I don't know the people. Never knew them.
Never even heard of them prior to them being killed. How about Larry Brown, Lawrence Brown? You ever hear of Lawrence Brown?
Not till cops started asking me about him, I don't have a clue who he is.
I'd gotten the same answer about Lawrence Brown, too. And I'd gotten the same answer about why Barentine thought it was that he'd gotten mixed up in this whole case in the first place.
Is there any reason you can think of outside of these statements at the party why these people might say you would have done
that? Well, a lot of these people would start getting off in trouble. They say whatever they need to say to get out.
For the most part, the things Donnie Barentine told me, well, they seem to be true. Or at least the things he said matched up well with everything else I knew about the case from other sources. Actually, when we first started talking, I thought I had caught him in a couple lies. For some of the questions I'd asked him about things like what the Wilkes County Mafia had been up to or why he'd been in Georgia when he was arrested back in 1985, he'd given answers that I knew couldn't be true, and that I knew he knew couldn't be true. Only, it turned out those lies had not been meant for me. As soon as his wife stepped out of the room, Barentine had circled back, speaking in a low voice, not quite a whisper. Actually, he'd say, here's how that really went down. And then he'd tell the story again, this time matching the facts as I knew them. Of course, that's not to say that Donnie Barentine answered all the questions I had. He didn't. Questions that he didn't want to answer, he'd sidestep, or he'd just start talking about something else entirely. Also, his favorite answer to any question is, well, what do you know about that? And unless I'd give him a clue about what I already knew, it'd be hard to get him talking on it. Still, at least for the things Barentine told me that I could independently verify, it all seemed to check out. And as for the things that Barentine told me that I couldn't independently verify, well, that part of his story was simple. No, he hadn't killed the Swains, he said. No, he didn't know who had. But he did know that whoever had done it was a damn fool. It was an insult to even have been accused of such a sloppy murder, Barentine told me. And besides, he'd never be caught dead wielding anything as pitiful as a .25 caliber, like the one used to kill the Swains. When I asked him about his arrests with David Robertson and Jeff Kittrell up in Telfer County, he told me about how annoyed he'd been to be arrested there of all places. Later, when the Telfer County Sheriff had come by to see him, Barentine told me about how he'd given the sheriff a piece of his mind. I told that son of a bitch, we're all in the same business here. Why are you doing this to me? Barentine actually has a good point here. This particular sheriff was one of the biggest drug traffickers in the county, and I guess as a matter of professional courtesy maybe, Barentine had expected the sheriff would let him go. That hadn't happened. Though, 5 years later on, it's worth noting, this particular sheriff would find himself on the other end of the stick when he himself was arrested for his role in a drug conspiracy. Still, even though the Telfer County sheriff hadn't let him walk out, Barentine had thought, at least initially, that he wouldn't be in jail for too long on these charges. He told me that a deal had been worked out, and a price had been agreed upon. For $30,000, Barentine, Robertson, and Kittrell would go free of the charges. Things had not worked out as planned. Donnie's cousin Greg Barentine had been the one who was supposed to make the payment, and he'd gotten the money together, $30,000 in cash. But when Greg Barentine had walked into the sheriff's office, instead of the sheriff there, he found 9 federal agents waiting for him. I was able to confirm the last part of Donnie Barentine's story, anyway, about how Greg Barentine was arrested. Because not long after Donnie Barentine was arrested in Telfair County, Greg Barentine had been indicted, along with 38 others, for their role in a drug conspiracy based out of Wilkes County, North Carolina. And on July 12th, when Greg Barentine had gone in to see the sheriff about some kind of business, the feds had been tipped off, and they were there waiting for him to arrest him. So Donnie Barentine hadn't gotten out of jail, and eventually, due to the Swain case, he was transferred down from Telfair County to Camden County. He told me a bit about what it had been like in the jail there, and a story about what he'd heard from the other inmates about some of the petty corruption they'd witnessed from the Camden County Sheriff's Office. The story was about something ridiculous that Sheriff Smith had done, though nothing to do with Donnie Barentine in particular. But while telling me about it, Barentine made a stray comment that I've been thinking a lot about ever since. You see, he said, in an almost exasperated tone, you could do just about any damn thing in Southeast Georgia back in those days if you had the money to give the sheriff.
Because so many records from the Swain case have gone missing over the years, we don't know a lot about what was said during most of Donnie Barentine's interviews with law enforcement. In fact, we don't even know when all the interviews with Barentine took place. For some of them, there's no paper record whatsoever, just the memories of the investigators who were involved. Take, for instance, two interviews of Donnie Barentine that were done sometime in mid-August of 1985, probably on August 16th and 17th. Butch Kennedy told Susan about it the first time she spoke to him. "I don't know if you know this," he said, "but I brought in an outside investigator at one point who interviewed Barentine. He'd gone to a law enforcement seminar not long before, and he'd been especially impressed by one of the instructors, a police officer from Atlanta who taught interrogation techniques. After Donnie Barentine's arrest, Butch Kennedy reached out to him to ask for his help in the case."
There was a speaker there by the name of, his last name is Foster. I called him, and he came down and interviewed Barentine. He told us what to do to isolate him for 24 hours. He came down and we went to Glenn County. That's where he was at. Glenn Foster.
Glenn Foster was his name, Butch Kennedy remembered. He'd driven down to Camden County, and on the evening he'd arrived, he'd gotten over to the Glenn County Jail, where Barentine was being held, and interviewed him there. Then, the next day, Barentine had been brought back over to the Camden County Courthouse, where he was interviewed again. And afterwards, Butch Kennedy remembers, Glenn Foster had seemed convinced that in pursuing Donnie Barentine as their suspect, the Camden County investigators were on the right track.
And he said, "That's your man. That is your man." From his interview, and we talked. He's gone, and he's gone forever.
Glenn Foster was gone forever from the case file, too, because there are no longer any written records today that mention this interview taking place.
What do you recall him saying in that second interview with Glenn Foster?
Actually, he was with him by himself. Glenn was.
Oh.
Foster. Foster was with him by himself. And after that, you know, we came back here, and Foster said, you know, "That's your man." I want to think that Foster followed up with a document. In fact, Glenn Thomas had the follow-up that Foster had sent back or sent to us.
If District Attorney Glenn Thomas had a follow-up report in this interview, he didn't put it in the DA's case file. Or at any rate, it's gone now. So if I wanted to find out more about this interview, I'd have to track down Glenn Foster and cross my fingers and hope that he actually recalled the case.
Well, how can I help you, ma'am?
Well, first off, do you even recall this case at all?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
This case, Glenn Foster told me, is not one that he'd ever been able to forget. He remembered it. He was still angry about it. He told me about getting the request from a deputy in Camden County and agreeing to come down and help with the case. He remembered a deputy and a GBI agent had briefed him on the Swain murders, and they'd had a suspect in custody. That's who he interviewed.
What we went through was just the basics, that apparently they'd come up with some leads. They thought that they had the three guys, one of the three guys, this kind of stuff. And I did talk to the one who described how the killing went down. It was too coincidental. He gave me a ton of stuff. He was arrested that night.
I realized suddenly that Glenn Foster must be thinking of some different case altogether, because what he was describing to me about a suspect who described how he'd done the murder definitely couldn't be the case I was working on. Or at least, that's what I thought at first.
What do you recall Barentine telling you in the interview?
He went through a description of what happened at the murder, how the three of them had come up to shut up a relative who was going to testify apparently in a trial, in a drug trial. And they wanted to come up. These guys were apparently hired. I'm vaguely remembering this because, again, I may be half off on this. I'll try and do the best I can. That when he was brought in, when they went to the church, that they called him to the outside. He came to the outside. He was shot. And as he went down, he grabbed the button off of one of the guys grabbed it, or the elderly black gentleman, the saint, as I called him to my dad, that he grabbed the shirt when he went down, and there was a button in his hand. And that's what that's about as far as I can remember about that interview. That's just about as far. And then he talked about how the gun was thrown off of a bridge as they left that scene, how the gun used for the killing was thrown off of a bridge. And I had to get him to narrow it down. And as to my recollection, that bridge was not checked for the gun, for the weapon.
What Glenn Foster was describing was a confession, like an actual confession. And it was definitely about the Swain case. Susan suddenly found herself in the middle of a very different conversation from the one she had been expecting.
Butch Kennedy remembers thinking that it was very important, but I did not know he'd actually confessed.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. He confessed. He did admit that he was there. He did admit that the gun was thrown away. He described the death scene. He also described the wife coming out there, and then she shot to death.
So when you had your interview with Barentine, did he, like, start talking pretty quick, or how'd that go?
I had to play a game with him. I had to play a game and manipulate him. I had to make him think I had something that he did not know about.
What Foster remembers now is that in this interview, he set the stage for Barentine to blame his accomplices for the murder. This was presumably Roberson and Cottrell, though this many years on, Foster doesn't recall any specific names.
And a guy like that will give up other people, is my observation. And once I trapped the other people through him, then I came back on him. And it took a little bit of time. It took a little bit of time, but he did talk.
Okay, but wait. If Barentine confessed to the murders, then why was this not a big deal? Because it seems like it should kind of have been a big deal. Glenn Foster had thought so, too. After he got the statement from Barentine, he'd figured the case was pretty well solved at that point, so he was already out of his way of Camden County when he got the call. The DA wouldn't sign the arrest warrants, he was told. There would be no case against Barentine and his accomplices.
I said, what are you talking about? I said, we got so much probable cause, it's a joke. I said, I've got this. And I said, you know, it's been heard. And I said, you know, everybody's in agreement. We've got PC. And I said, what are you talking about?
When Foster found out that D.A. Glenn Thomas was refusing to charge Barentine in the Swain case, he was convinced something had gone horribly wrong in Camden County. And he decided that in order to address it, he had to escalate the matter.
I was so angry. Matter of fact, after it was over, when our beloved district attorney would not give a warrant, when I left, I went to Atlanta, made some phone calls, and I got in to see that one of the chief investigators for the state, for the attorney general's office. And we had a long meeting. The first thing he told me, I've heard about a lot of corruption in Brunswick. I've heard about the district attorney. And so I told him what I had. And then he went down and they did not tell the truth. I'm not talking about the police. I'm talking about what they went down and did, because I had him call me later. And he said, Glenn, nobody was talking. And I said, here's what I got. I said, that's different than from what you're hearing.
From what Glenn Foster can remember now, after he tried to get the AG's office involved, they had gone down to Brunswick and looked into it. But even then, in 1985, not long after, whenever it was this took place, the record of Glenn Foster's interview was already gone.
I then made a phone call to the U.S. attorney, to the attorney general's office through some connections, and got the chief of the Civil Rights Division on the phone, laid out what I had. I said, This is unbelievable. I said, you know, there's enough to arrest all these guys. And I said, the one told me the following, and I went through all the details on that. After about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour of talking, he said, Glenn, it doesn't meet civil rights violation. And I said, in other words, killing an innocent black man in a church is not civil rights. And I said, these were whites that did it. And I said, is there any angle that you could come up with? Is there any way I can help you? And he said, no. I said, oh, great. Nice to talk to you. So that was the end of it. That was the end of it.
The FBI was right, though. This isn't a case that would provide grounds for federal jurisdiction. And after the FBI turned him down, Glenn Foster had no higher authorities he could appeal to. And the report he filed in the matter no longer seemed to exist anywhere.
That was Thomas that destroyed it. Guarantee 100%. You can quote me on that. It's the only way, because he's the last one that had the records and he was dumping stuff. That's the only thing that makes sense. And they do have the wrong guy in jail, because this guy told me too much stuff that only the killer would know. The button is the secret, ma'am. They came off his shirt. They came off a shirt. I'm trying to remember if it was his or if it was the bad guy. And he told me about that, and nobody knew that but us.
Up until very recently, I was that person who was always interested in investing in the stock market, but had no idea where to start. I'll be honest, I was completely intimidated, and I just had no idea how to do it, and so I just never did, until I got the Robinhood app. Let me tell you about Robinhood. It's an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, options, ETFs, cryptos, all commission-free. But that's not the only amazing thing about it. The thing about Robinhood is that it is a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers like me to invest for the first time with real confidence. And they make financial services work for everybody. It's not just for the wealthy. I love the app. It is simple, it's intuitive, there's a clear design, the data is presented in an easy digest way. They've got easy to understand charts and market data. You can actually place a trade just using four taps on your smartphone. Another great thing about the app is that the Robinhood web platform lets you view stock collections. So for example, the 100 most popular stocks. You can look for stocks by sectors like entertainment and social media. They even have curated categories like female CEOs, and they give you analyst ratings of buy, hold, sell for every single stock. What I love is that I have learned to invest as I've built my portfolio by using the app. I've discovered new stocks and I'm tracking favorite companies with my own personalized newsfeed. And don't forget, once again, there's no commission fees, okay? Other brokerages charge up to 10 bucks for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission. All of your profits stay in your pocket. Kind of crazy, huh? Robinhood is giving our listeners a free stock, completely free. Merry Christmas, folks. Like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at undisclosed.robinhood.com. Once again, that's undisclosed.robinhood.com.
I can understand why this detail about the button stands out so strongly in Glenn Foster's memory, even if he can't recall now exactly why the button had been significant. Buttons were a key detail about the crime scene. During the brief but frantic struggle in the vestibule, Harold Swain must have ripped the killer's shirt open at some point. Popping off five navy blue buttons and sending them flying, cast out in an arc to every corner of the small room. But the killer must have been pulling at Harold Swain's shirt too, because in addition to the five navy buttons, there was a single white button that was also found. It had been pulled off of Harold Swain's shirt and had fallen just beside his body. On Harold Swain's shirt, the button below the missing one had been pulled loose too, though it was still hanging on by a thread. And this is not in any of the reports I've seen in the case file, but here's one reason that a confession referencing a button could be a big deal. Harold Swain was shot in the chest three times, and all three shots went through the right side of Harold Swain's shirt, but only one shot went through the right side of Harold Swain's chest. One of the shots was in the middle, and the third shot was 4 inches to the left of the middle. Which means, at the moment those shots were fired, the right side of Harold Swain's shirt must have been pulled over to the left side of his body. The image that keeps playing in my mind is of the killer grappling with Harold Swain in the vestibule, grabbing hold of the other man's shirt with one hand and firing his gun with the other. And as Harold Swain falls, a button pulling free of the shirt and into the killer's hand. Maybe, anyway. Or maybe not. Without Glenn Foster's report, there's no way to know exactly what Donnie Parentine said about these buttons or how much it really matched the crime scene. After talking to Glenn Foster, I had more questions than I did answers, but probably the biggest question I had was how come Butch Kennedy had never thought to mention this whole confession thing to me? Next time I was down in Camden County along with Dennis Perry's GIP attorney, Jennifer Whitfield, we met with Butch Kennedy and asked him again about what he could remember of the Foster interview.
What happened after that?
I remember him telling us that if he wasn't the person that committed this offense, that he was there or he was part of it.
Did he tell you what was said in the interview?
No. If he did, I don't recall him.
I'll admit I'd wondered if perhaps Butch Kennedy had been trying to subtly tip me off somehow when he told me about Glenn Foster. If maybe Kennedy had known about the confession, but for some reason couldn't tell me directly and instead had only hinted at it.
So I spoke to Glenn Foster.
Okay.
And what he told me, he came down, he did the interview, and he says that Barentine confessed to him.
Really?
Butch Kennedy was just as surprised as I had been about all this, and just as confused about why he hadn't known about it already.
So you didn't know that Branton had confessed to him?
No.
Okay.
I would think that he would have shared that with me. And something that important, you know. Did he tell me?
I'd also don't think Glenn Foster did tell Butch Kennedy about it, though. Foster hadn't known that Kennedy didn't know about the confession, but he didn't have any specific memory either of telling Kennedy about it. And Foster and Kennedy did not know one another socially. They had no relationship beyond the fact that Kennedy once attended a seminar taught by Foster. After Glenn Foster left Camden County that day, believing that an arrest warrant was being issued for Donnie Barentine, he and Kennedy had never crossed paths again.
And if Butch Kennedy had been told about a confession from Donnie Barentine, is that really something he could have forgotten, even after 3 decades?
What would you have done if he told you that, if you'd known?
Double backflip.
Whatever it was, though, that Glenn Foster told Butch Kennedy about his interview with Barentine, it does seem as if it prompted Butch Kennedy to take some action in the case.
Well, it's interesting because it seems like you drafted an arrest warrant not long after those interviews. And so I'm curious what happened with that arrest warrant?
That is the arrest warrant that Joe Gregory carried to the district attorney. And do you know the response that we got from that?
I'm not going to have crackheads and whores in my courtroom. That was the response they got from the DA, which is why Donnie Barentine was not charged with the murder and instead handed over to federal custody on the weapons charge.
Does it surprise you that he didn't share with you those details or with Joe Gregory as far as you know?
It does. It really does. And I don't know that he did not.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
I don't know that he may have told us that and that we worked on that. I just don't remember him saying, but I do remember him saying, that's your guy. That is your guy.
There's one other person that Glenn Foster might have told about this interview, and that's GBI agent Joe Gregory. Susan called him up to ask whether there was anything he remembered about an outside investigator who'd come to interview Barentine.
Does that ring any bells?
No.
When Susan started to tell him what happened, Joe Gregory's instant guess was, oh, don't tell me, some federal agent cut Barentine a deal, didn't they? Someone had come in and decided to convince Barentine to cooperate by getting him cut loose on the Swain case, something like that? Well, no, she told Gregory, that's not quite it.
He, actually, Donnie Barentine confessed to the murder.
To Foster?
Yeah, to Glenn Foster.
So. Okay, I wouldn't doubt that a bit.
You didn't hear that?
And Foster... No, why didn't Foster come forward with that information?
He did. He gave it to Glenn Thomas.
Susan told Joe Gregory that after Glenn Thomas had done nothing about Glenn Foster's report, Glenn Foster had tried to pursue the matter further. He'd gone to the state attorney general's office and the FBI about it.
He didn't even go to the right state or the right local. But I can see where he's coming from. And we had the same problem, you know, ourselves. Who we could trust and who we couldn't.
Today, there are no documents in the case file that reference Glenn Foster's interview with Donnie Barentine. But that case file also had that videotaped recording of Barentine's 2002 interview with investigators. And in that video, toward the end of the interview, there's an interesting exchange that happens.
Many years ago when you were in jail with all this mess, of the thing, McRae and all that, you were interviewed by a man named B.P. Foster. Do you remember that?
That's GBI agent Schroll that's speaking there. He asked Donnie Barentine if he remembers an interview with someone named Dixie Foster. And after a long pause, Barentine shakes his head slightly. No, he doesn't remember that. As for who or what Dixie Foster is, well, that isn't explained, and we'd never seen that name before.
Lately, he interviewed you twice. I think he's someone who's gone in by the sheriff's office, correct?
The grainy video footage obscures Barentine's face some, but not so much that you can't tell how unhappy he is about the questions Agent Schroll is asking. In fact, Barentine is so unresponsive that it seems to make Agent Schroll doubt his own questions. I think he's someone brought in by the sheriff's office, Agent Schroll tells Barentine. And then Agent Schroll turns his head to look directly at Del Bundy, who's sitting beside him. Correct, Agent Schroll asks. In the audio, the sounds all blur together, but in the video recording, Del Bundy's response is clear. He nods his head twice. Yes, Del Bundy confirms. Dixie Foster was someone brought in by the sheriff's office.
When you talked to Mr. Foster years ago, apparently at some point during the interview, according to what I've read in the previous case file, you said, "I did." And then immediately you went back and said, "I'm just kidding." Do you remember that?
No. The very first time I watched this tape, before I'd spoken to Glenn Foster, this section of the interview had seemed curious to me and confusing, but it didn't strike me as necessarily super important. I had no context for any of it, and the way Agent Troll asked this question, it makes it seem like nothing that big of a deal. It was as if Donnie Barentine had, at some point after his arrest in 1985, told some random investigator, "Hey, guess what? I killed the Swains. Psych." But listen again to what Agent Troll is saying here.
According to what I've read in the previous case file, you said...
According to what he'd read in the previous case file. Yeah, that's a big deal. Agent Troll is confirming that there was a written report about some guy or something named Dixie Foster who would interview Donnie Barentine. There was a report. The state had it. In 2002, less than a year before Dennis Perry's trial. It was in the case file. So what the hell happened to it?
Two murders, four convictions, and a town full of secrets. Based on John Grisham's only true crime bestseller, The Innocent Man, injustice is only the beginning. This new Netflix documentary about two cases that shook the small town of Ada, Oklahoma in the 1980s is reopened with revealing DNA evidence that has everyone questioning if the right men were charged or if the killer is still out there. The Innocent Man astonishingly outlines the unbelievable perfect storm of prosecutorial misconduct, an inadequate defense led by a blind attorney, misconstrued forensic evidence, and a small town full of secrets. We get an in-depth look at the all-too-common miscarriages of justice and ultimately the subjective nature of truth. Although convictions have been made, there is still no justice or peace for anyone involved. It's a shocking portrait of how easily your life can be taken when you're up against a corrupt system that has everyone feeling powerless, no matter what the evidence says. The Innocent Man is now streaming, only on Netflix. It's at this point in the interview tape, right after Agent Troll asks about the Dixie Foster report, that you can see Donnie Barentine suddenly lean forward in his chair, hands resting on the table in front of him. He redirects his gaze from Agent Troll to Dale Bundy. It is Dale Bundy that Barentine starts questioning.
Were you involved in that?
Yeah, no way,
You know what was going on up there?
Yeah.
All right, the deal was, I was taken up there and put down John Doe. The word I get from this guy is you stay here until you either confess or go crazy. And it probably went down like that, except there was some old jailer, I never knew his name, and he's real old, he's probably retired now. This was a deal of no contact.
The strangeness of this whole exchange between three investigators and a witness they're interviewing is even more pronounced when you watch the video.
The deal was...
He's running the show now.
That's exactly what I said when I watched that video. Verbatim.
Donnie Barentine is running the show, and he knows exactly what this whole Dixie Foster thing is about. I was taken to Glenn County Jail, he says, and booked under the name John Doe. And that did happen. We know that because in the DA's file there are copies of three letters that Barentine wrote to his family while he was in Glenn County. And in those letters he talks about how they'll have to write to him as John Doe now if they want to reach him. His letters to his family are signed, Love, Donnie Barentine, or John Doe, whichever. And what Donnie Barentine describes in those letters sounds exactly like what he's telling Bundy in his interview, 17 years later. He says the same things word for word even. He writes in one letter,
They want me to confess to some murders. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to say I did it because I didn't do it. So they're going to keep me in the hole until I confess or go crazy. I'm going to go crazy already. It's cold in here.
Donnie Barentine also makes frequent references to being interviewed by someone. In one letter to his wife, he writes,
I need to see a lawyer bad. The man I've been talking to won't tell me what his name is. I don't know why.
In these letters, Barentine begins to refer to this interviewer as the man with no name. As in, the man with no name is saying a lot of things about Greg, or the man with no name wants me to confess. I didn't kill them, and I ain't gonna say I did. And it's clear from what he's writing home that Donnie Barentine is very worried about the situation he's in. He writes things like, "It looks like I'm gonna be in jail for a while. Tell Marty I'll see him in 20 years. And they tell me if I don't fry in Georgia, I'll fry in Florida, but that's crazy. Besides, on death row, you can at least have visitors. And my hair is starting to fall out. I don't know why." He also asks his family repeatedly, "Find out where I was March 11th. And call my employer and find out about March 11th and 12th if you can. It was either then or when Boo and Jeff painted Jeff's sister's house." In other words, someone needs to go and check on his alibi.
The timelines here aren't entirely clear, but based on what we know of when Barentine was transferred between various jails, these letters were written on Monday, August 19th, 1985. That's 2 days after the day that Glenn Foster would have had his interview with Donnie Barentine. And Glenn Foster, I think, must be Barentine's man with no name. In these letters, Barentine never directly references what he told the man with no name, but based on what Barentine is writing home about, it's obvious that something didn't go well, and Barentine is severely stressed about what's going to happen to him now. And throughout these letters, he makes multiple references to serving 20 years in prison.
In the taped interview, Donnie Barentine never actually answers the question about what happened in this interview with Dixie Foster, or the man with no name, or whatever name it is that Donnie Barentine knows him by. Instead, Barentine just skips ahead further in the story, avoids it entirely. And Del Bundy is fine with this. He makes no attempt to get an actual answer out of Barentine. Actually, Del Bundy does the exact opposite. He steps in to give Barentine an out.
Them days were kind of fuzzy.
You were just jerking the police around a little bit, right? Del Bundy asks. The implication is clear. If Barentine happened to make any confessions while talking to this Dixie Foster, they don't actually mean anything, because Barentine was just trolling the police. It's a nonsense idea, though, and it's not based on anything Donnie Barentine told Bundy when he described what happened at the Glynn County Jail.
From what's said on the Barentine tape, it seems as if Dixie Foster and Glenn Foster and the man with no name must be all one and the same person. But where did this name Dixie Foster even come from? I've got an answer to that question, at least. While trying to schedule a call to talk to Glenn Foster about it, I ended up talking to Foster's business partner first, and I asked him, "Hey, by the way, do you know who Dixie Foster is?" There was a pause and then a ventured guess. "I think that's Glenn's wife." He tried to puzzle it out for a moment and then suddenly started laughing. "No, wait, that's Glenn," he said. "Dixie is his first name. But please don't tell him I told you that, because he doesn't like using that name."
Dixie Glenn Foster. That's who Dixie was. But knowing that only solves part of the mystery.
"What's this about my name? I don't remember ever filing a report, ma'am, with the name Dixie on it. I don't know where somebody came up with that. Maybe they heard it somewhere, because I never go by that name."
Glenn Foster was just as confused as we were about where Agent Trull could have gotten the name Dixie from, and just as confused by Agent Trull's claims that Barentine had been playing some kind of practical joke when he confessed to the murder.
At the very end, it's casual. The GBI agent asked Barentine, "What is this about an interview you had with Dixie Foster? I read the report, and you confessed. But then you said, 'I'm just kidding.'"
No. See, Susan, it's like I told you. He admitted the button. I remember that part. He remembered it. And that was the reason we had enough PC when I trapped him, you know, for warrants and things like this. And I filed a report. I know I did. Because I would always file something on a case."
Glenn Foster acknowledges that after 33 years, there's a lot about the Barentine interview he might not remember now. But Donnie Barentine confessing to him and then immediately saying, "just kidding," that is not something that he thinks could have happened.
"You don't recall that about him saying, 'I'm just kidding'?"
No, nobody kids about confessing, ma'am. I'm sorry.
But the "just kidding" stuff aside, what Agent Charles' comments in the Barentine tape confirm is that somewhere out in the world, there's a document that describes how, in August of 1985, Donnie Barentine was interviewed and he told the interviewer, "I did it." So why did this report disappear? And why was it never given to Dennis Perry's defense?
I can't explain why, back in 1985, D.A. Glenn Thomas would have wanted to hide the existence of the Foster interview. But as for why in 2003 the DA's office would have wanted to hide the existence of the Foster interview, well, that's pretty obvious. Assistant DA John Johnson wanted Dennis Perry to be convicted and executed, and it would make his job a lot harder to do if it was known that another man had confessed to the murders.
John Johnson couldn't avoid handing over the videotape of Barentine's 2002 interview, though, and when defense attorney Dale Westling watched the tape, he too was confused by Agent Troll's questions about Dixie Foster. So Dennis Perry's attorney followed up with a letter to John Johnson about it.
"In again reviewing the Donnie Barentine tape, I picked up the name Dixie Foster. Apparently, Mr. Foster interviewed Barentine early on in the case. I do not have any reports or notes of the interview. Please forward them to me at your earliest convenience. Also, I need Donnie Barentine's address. Although he wrote it down for Mr. Bundy, he did not state it out loud."
John Johnson received this letter on April 17, 2002. As far as we can tell, he never sent a response to Dennis Perry's defense about it, but Johnson did respond to someone else. The very next day, on April 18th, he sent an email to Donnie Barentine. This is the same email, by the way, that we discussed earlier on the show, in episode 18. The one where Prosecutor John Johnson writes to Barentine to give him a heads up. "Hey, just so you know, the defense is looking for you. Don't worry, I won't give them your address just yet, but they'll probably find you eventually. And oh, John Johnson writes to Barentine, by the way, if you deny you said those things that people have said you said, then the defense can bring in those people and have them say you did say those things and make it look like you killed the Swains."
And John Johnson's plan, because it's impossible to see this as anything but a plan, was successful. At Dennis Perry's trial, when Donnie Barentine got on the stand to testify, the defense did bring this issue up. They asked him, "Did you ever confess to a gentleman named Dixie Foster, a police officer?" And Donnie Barentine responds, "Not that I know of." And that's that. The defense attorney, apparently deciding not to continue asking questions he doesn't already know the answer to, moves on to other matters and never raises Dixie Foster again. Besides, it probably wasn't important anyway. John Johnson had told the defense that he handed over all Brady material. And since Johnson hadn't handed over anything about this interview with Dixie Foster, well, it must not have been anything important.
But what about Dale Bundy? When I interviewed Bundy down at the sheriff's office in Camden County, I hadn't known anything about Dixie Foster or Glenn Foster or any kind of confession that Barentine had made to law enforcement. And Bundy obviously never volunteered anything about it. Bundy told me that he'd cleared Barentine and that the reason Butch Kennedy and Joe Gregory had never solved this case is because they had tunnel vision on Donnie Barentine and that it stopped them from making real progress. But in 2002, Dale Bundy had definitely known about Dixie Foster and the Barentine confession. We know this because there is literally a videotape of Dale Bundy confirming that he knew about Dixie Foster and the Barentine confession. So why didn't Bundy mention this in any of his reports? And why didn't he make any effort to investigate it? I talked to Dale Bundy about it, hoping he might be able to explain more about what happened, or, not to get my hopes up too much, but possibly maybe even he'd be able to give me some ideas on where the written report might be today. So I called him and asked him about it, but, well, let's just say the conversation didn't go all that great. Long story short, Dale Bundy is not going to be able to help us with the answers here. Bundy denies that he ever had any knowledge of the Foster interview, and it's going to take a lot more than just a videotape of him confirming he knew about it for him to change his mind on this. While working on this case, there was a story I'd heard from someone who'd known Barentine back in the 80s and 90s that I hadn't really been able to make sense of at the time. This man I was talking to was not close to Donnie Barentine and had never spoken to him directly about the case. But he was close to people who had spoken to Barentine about it, and they'd told him about some of their conversations with him. Everything this man knew was secondhand and fairly vague. All he knew, he said, is that Barentine had told friends and relatives they had in common that he'd done the murders up in Georgia, at the church. But, Barentine said, they'd messed up somehow. They'd gone to the wrong church and killed the wrong people. And he said, Donnie Barentine had told people that while he was in jail up in Georgia, he'd confessed to doing the murders, but they wouldn't believe him. At first, I'd assumed what the guy meant was that Donnie Barentine had confessed in jail to another inmate, Or maybe a jailhouse informant had claimed Barentine had confessed, something like that. That made sense to me. After all, Jeff Kitchell kind of had said that. But then the man clarified, no, like, to the police. The confession was to the police. Barentine had confessed while he was in jail, only the police hadn't believed him. When I heard this story, I kind of dismissed it. Everything this man knew was secondhand, and it was so easy to assume that the story about Barentine confessing to the police and the police not believing it, well, the obvious explanation is that this is just a secondhand story that's gotten garbled around in the retelling. Something like that. After talking to Glenn Foster, though, I realized the story about Barentine confessing and not being believed, it actually makes a lot of sense. Especially because, from the perspective of Donnie Barentine, that might have been what this all seemed like. He'd known he'd confessed, but he'd never gotten charged with anything, so for some reason, the police must not have believed him. And then there's another story I heard that seems to corroborate what Glenn Foster told me, at least a little bit. This story came from someone who'd called into Unsolved Mysteries in 1988. I've mentioned this tip story before, actually, in a previous episode. It was the Unsolved Mysteries tip that, out of all the tips, I was most fascinated by. It was the tip that I most wanted to know more about, because the tipster had called in some very specific info about how someone in the Barentine family, it's not clear who, had committed the murders because the Swains had a relative who might testify against the Wilkes County Mafia. But I couldn't find this tipster. No one could. I knew from the files that over the years, both before and after Dennis Perry's trial, attempts had been made to find him, but the caller could never be located. I spent a lot of time on it, but had to stop because I just wasn't getting anywhere. Then, one day, while thumbing through some files, there was a stray line in one of the documents that caught my eye. I'd read this line probably a dozen times before, but for whatever reason, when I saw it this time, everything clicked into place. I knew who the Wilkes County Mafia tipster had been. So I called him, and although he was surprised to hear from someone about a 30-year-old Unsolved Mysteries tip, he confirmed that, yes, he'd been the one to call that tip in, and he was willing to tell me what he knew. Back in the late 1980s, he said, not long after when Donnie Barentine was released from federal prison on the weapons charge, he and Barentine had been friends, and Barentine had told him all about the murders at a church in Georgia. Though Barentine had never claimed that he'd done the murders, the tipster said. Barentine hadn't been telling the tipster that he personally was responsible for the crime. He was telling the tipster that he'd known who'd done it and why they'd done it. And according to the tipster, that reason was, quote, the motive is the preacher had a son who was supposed to testify. The son snitched on the Wilkes Mafia family, but the Mafia could not touch the son because he was in a witness protection program. So they got back by killing the preacher and his wife. It's almost the same story that Glenn Foster recalls Donnie Barentine telling him back in 85. And it would seem Donnie Barentine kept telling that story even after he got out of prison. At some point in August of 1985, Donnie Barentine made a statement implicating himself in the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain. That much I feel very confident about at this point. But the question of whether Donnie Barentine confessed to the murders is a different question from whether Donnie Barentine committed the murders. The first question I feel is answered, but the second is not. First off, Donnie Barentine has almost definitely falsely confessed to murders before. Not ever in a custodial context that I know of, but in social settings decades ago, yeah, Barentine has claimed to do murders that he probably hadn't done. Or at least, I think he probably hadn't done. And I know this because a few people have told me that Barentine implied to them he'd done this certain crime, but at this point, I am like 98% sure that crime never even happened in the first place. Or take the unsolved shooting of a man in Marianna, Florida, who was summoned to the front door of his house one night and shot 6 times. The man survived somehow, but when he tried to call for help, the phone lines had been cut. That happened in June 1985, and Jeff Kitchell said Barentine was responsible for it. When I got the case file for the shooting, there Barentine's name was in the police notes. Someone had called in and said Barentine had claimed to them that he'd done it. Although, that's also the only evidence really that I've seen that Barentine was involved in the case somehow. So, putting these other cases aside, what about the contents of Donnie Barentine's statements in the Swain case? Is there anything to corroborate the story he told Glenn Foster is true? Unfortunately, that's not really a call we can make right now because we don't actually know what Donnie Barentine told Glenn Foster. Foster recalls some of it, but not specifics, and not enough to independently verify how credible this statement really was. And the basic story about Donnie Barentine that we know of comes from Jeff Kitchell. And no one I've talked to who knew Jeff Kitchell has described him as credible. Just the opposite, in fact. His brother told me that Jeff Kitchell had always had a hell of an imagination. You give him one detail, and he'll tell you a story that runs miles with it. I wouldn't convict nobody on what he said, he told me. I asked him, If your brother had testified at a trial, should a jury have believed what he said? And God, I hope they wouldn't, Kitchell's brother told me. But probably the most ominous message in Barentine's letters home, and the one that makes me wonder the most about whether I've been too quick to discredit anything said by Jeff Kitchell, comes from a letter where Barentine explains to his family why he's in Glynn County and not in Camden County like he'd been before. He writes, I think the real reason I'm here is Jeff is talking, so they separated us. They know things only he could have told them. Which suggests that there must have been some truth to what Jeff Kitchell was saying if the information he gave led Barentine to conclude Jeff is talking. Though the way Barentine writes about Kitchell in these letters seems bizarrely sympathetic given how contemptuous Barentine is of Jeff Kitchell today. Barentine knew these letters were being monitored, so that might explain it. But Barentine writes things like, I never would have believed that Jeff would break, but he had a reason. I will tell you about it later. And he writes, I'm not mad at him. Jeff just took all that he could and he finally broke. And part of me wonders, given that probably just 2 days before he wrote these letters, Barentine himself had made statements implicating himself in the murders. Is Barentine talking entirely about Kitchell here, or could he be talking also about himself? I called up Donnie Barentine to tell him about what I'd found, and to ask him about the man with no name. I didn't know about him when I talked to you before, I said, but I found him and I talked to him, and he told me that you would confess to him. That never happened, Barentine said. I have no idea what you're talking about, and whoever you're talking to, they're lying. It wasn't so much the existence of an interview with a man with no name that Donnie Barentine was denying. He more or less acknowledged that took place. He'd been interviewed by a man with no name, and the man with no name's goal had been to make Barentine confess or to make Barentine go crazy, whichever came first. But when I asked Barentine if he could have said something to the man with no name that amounted to a confession, or maybe if he could have just been pulling the guy's chain and pretending to confess to him for some reason, Barentine was just as adamant. No way, no how, didn't happen. Why would Barentine have said anything like that? He hadn't killed the Swains, so why would he confess to it? People sometimes confess to things they haven't done, I told him. But Barentine didn't budge on his denial. That'd be stupid, he said. Why would someone do something like that? Why would he do something like that? He wouldn't have. Wouldn't happen. And he definitely never would have pretended to confess to a murder as a joke, because that would be completely stupid. And, well, I couldn't disagree with him on this last part. But the Donnie Barentine was so adamant that he couldn't have confessed to Glenn Foster actually kind of surprised me a little. Because one thing that struck me when I talked to him before was this almost implied acknowledgement that, yeah, in an alternate universe, the investigators might have succeeded in convincing him to falsely confess. Because for a time there, he'd been in a rough spot while over in Glynn County. Confess or go crazy, the man with no name told him. And for a time, it seemed to Barentine like he might do one or the other. Barentine made similar comments to Dale Bundy back in 2002 as well.
The word I get from this guy is you stay here until you either confess or go crazy. And it probably went down like that. Except there was some old jailer, I never knew his name.
It probably would have gone down like that, Donnie Barentine had said. He either would have gone crazy, or he would have confessed to the murders. Those were the options left to him. The only reason things hadn't gone down that way is because of the intervention of a kindly but unnamed jailer, who'd given Barentine the support he needed to get an attorney and put a stop to the interrogations. Or something like that. But what would have happened if this kindly jailer hadn't intervened? Or what if this jailer hadn't actually existed? Maybe he is real, but Barentine has always been very vague on the details about this guy's existence. He never knew the man's name, he said, just an older man who'd shown Barentine some kindness when he was in a bad spot. And this jailer had, at the exact right time, come to Barentine's rescue. He hadn't liked the way Barentine was being interrogated, Barentine told me. He hadn't thought it was right. So somehow, in some vaguely defined way, this kindly jailer had done something that had stopped the man with no name, and the man with no name hadn't bothered Barentine anymore. I wondered, though, could the kindly jailer's intervention have been nothing more than an alternate ending that Donnie Barentine had written for himself? One where the story ends the way he wishes it had, rather than the way it actually did? Because, at least according to Glenn Foster, the kindly jailer in Glynn County must have come too late. He hadn't succeeded in stopping Barentine from confessing to the man with no name.
When it comes to Donnie Barentine's stories about how or why he could have been involved in this, the most consistent theory of his motive has to do with the Swains' relative, Lawrence Brown. But confirmation that some kind of connection might exist between Barentine and Brown has proven elusive. Not long after the Swains were killed, Lawrence Brown was arrested for his role in a drug trafficking conspiracy that imported drugs from Jamaica. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. From the records we have about his arrest and the case against him, there's nothing that obviously links what Brown was involved in to any of the known activities that the Wilkes County Mafia was involved in. From Lawrence Brown's prison records, though, there's at least a suggestion that some kind of link could exist between the two.
After Lawrence Brown's arrest in April of 1985, he made bond and was released and pled guilty in May. 2 months later, on July 15, 1985, Brown surrendered himself to a prison in the Florida Panhandle to serve his sentence. The same day, in fact, that the grand jury in the Western District of North Carolina had returned their 39-name indictment in the Wilkes County Mafia case. In October, 1 week before the Wilkes County Mafia trial was scheduled to begin, Lawrence Brown was transferred out somewhere on a writ from the prison in Florida. The problem is, we don't know where. The paperwork doesn't specify it. 1 week after the Wilkes County Mafia trial was over, Lawrence Brown was transferred back again to his original prison from wherever it was that he had gone to. But even though we don't know where he went, we do have a clue about what he was doing while he was there. In a progress review report for Lawrence Brown, a prison official wrote,
"Good work and behavior. Recently returned from writ. Inmate expecting reduction in sentence."
Lawrence Brown's expectations were correct. Eventually, his 10-year sentence was cut in half, and after serving 2.5 years in all, he was released from prison. After that, he was a confidential informant for law enforcement. Paperwork shows that he helped the GBI out on at least a couple of cases. Reading between the lines here, it is very likely that Lawrence Brown was a cooperating witness on some investigation or trial that was going on somewhere. And this was all taking place at the exact same time as the Wilkes County Mafia trial. But while that's intriguing, it doesn't prove anything. None of the records from the Wilkes County case that we've been able to obtain so far have mentioned Lawrence Brown, and none of the people involved in the conspiracy have remembered him. At the same time, though, there's no guarantee that Brown's name would be there if he was an informant. In fact, there are people in the Wilkes County group who we have confirmed were working with the government to build a case others involved in the operation, but you can barely find any reference to them whatsoever in their investigative records.
Which is why the whole Lawrence Brown angle to this case has been so completely maddening, every step of the way. Even though everything we've found has shown that it's possible that Lawrence Brown was cooperating with the government somehow in connection with the Wilkes County Mafia case, nothing we've found has confirmed that it actually was the Wilkes County Mafia case and not some other drug case somewhere. Which means, for now, this part of Donnie Parentine's confession to Glenn Foster remains unconfirmed.
Of course, none of this matters anyway if Dennis Perry isn't allowed to ever tell a court about what happened to him. None of what we've discussed in this entire season matters. Right now, as the law stands, a prosecutor can do anything to win a conviction against the defendant. Plant evidence, bribe witnesses, whatever it takes, and just so long as the prosecutor manages to convince that defendant to waive every possible constitutional or statutory right he has to challenge that misconduct, there's nothing the defendant can do about it. And that's what John Johnson has argued is Dennis Perry's inescapable fate here. It doesn't matter what John Johnson did to convict Dennis Perry. All of that is beyond judicial review, because Dennis Perry gave up his right to ever tell a court about what happened to him.
When Dennis Perry was convicted on February 14, 2003, his attorneys told him that if he didn't accept the sentencing agreement that the state was offering, he would almost certainly be executed. During the 45-minute span between his conviction and his acceptance of the sentencing agreement, the defense attorneys told Dennis that when a defendant had been convicted, there's really only two people a defendant can blame, either the judge for making an error or defense counsel for being ineffective. And in this case, he said, he was unlikely to succeed in appealing on either issue, which meant you either take the sentencing agreement or you die. Dennis Perry told them he did not want to die. When Dennis was brought back into court, Judge Amanda Williams asked him if he wanted to accept the deal that had been offered by the state. Judge Williams said,
"Okay, do you understand for the record what has occurred here? That the state has said they will withdraw their seeking of the death penalty in this case, and that your attorney has basically said to this court, for and in consideration of that, that you're willing to give up your right to appeal the sentence and all possible appealable issues in the trial of this case, and for you giving up those rights, the state is willing to give up its right to seek the death sentence here. Do you understand that?"
"Yes, ma'am," Dennis Perry responded. The deal was done. Dennis's brother Daniel remembers that night at the courthouse, after Dennis had entered into the sentencing agreement, his family had not yet grasped its significance. He and some other family members were out in a court hallway talking to one another about what they should do next in Dennis's case.
One of the prosecuting attorneys came out and he walked past us and he said, y'all better stop talking about it because there's nothing you can do. And even if the murderer walks up tomorrow and confesses, Dennis Perry will stay in prison because of the no appeal. You know, we didn't know anything about that. We thought that was bogus. There's no way. And you shut up, mister. You know, and that's when we figured out a little after that that attorney was right.
Dennis Perry did attempt a legal challenge, though. A couple weeks after his conviction, he got a new attorney, Richard Darden, who filed a habeas petition on Dennis Perry's behalf. The habeas was limited in scope. Although a waiver of appellate rights is valid and enforceable, that kind of waiver has to be made knowingly and voluntarily, and in his habeas petition, Darden argued that Dennis Perry had been coerced into the sentencing agreement, and therefore the agreement was invalid. Dennis Perry lost. His waiver of appellate rights had been both knowing and voluntary, the court found. And that was that. According to Prosecutor John Johnson, all of Dennis Perry's days in court were forever over, and he waived any right to challenge his conviction ever again.
John Johnson is wrong about that. That's not what Dennis Perry agreed to. At the hearing on the sentencing agreement, John Johnson himself told the court that the state had made an offer to Dennis Perry that, quote, if the defendant will give up his right to appeal the conviction and sentence in this case, the state will give up the death penalty.
But remember, appellate rights are not the only rights that a convicted defendant has. There are other post-conviction rights, and a habeas petition is not an appeal. It's not even a criminal proceeding. It's a civil action challenging a detention by the government. The government can't ask a defendant to waive his appellate rights and then turn around and claim, well, a habeas petition has some things in common, sort of, with the criminal appeal, so the court should conclude the defendant has forfeited all those rights as well. Just last week, the Supreme Court of Georgia issued its decision in Rawls v. Holt, in which a defendant had entered into agreement to waive his appellate rights, but was challenging a lower court's denial of his right to file a habeas petition. And in that case, the court held,
in this case, there was no written waiver, and the colloquy between the trial court and the defendant shows that the defendant understood that he was specifically waiving his right to appeal, and that the defendant affirmed that he made the decision to waive that right freely and voluntarily. The record does not show, however, that he knowingly waived the right to petition for a writ of habeas corpus. Because the state has failed to meet its burden of showing a knowing waiver of the defendant's right to file a petition for habeas corpus, we reverse the judgment of the habeas court.
Now, in the Rawls case, the defendant's habeas rights actually had been discussed as part of the sentencing agreement, but due to a confusing slip of the tongue by the trial court, those habeas rights weren't discussed effectively. But in Dennis's case, there's no indication whatsoever that at the time of the sentencing agreement, a waiver of habeas rights had ever been contemplated by anyone in the courtroom. Dennis Perry's habeas rights weren't on the table and not part of any deal. Although later on, weeks after the sentencing agreement was entered into, John Johnson does seem to have contemplated whether he should have asked for more when he negotiated Dennis Perry's sentencing agreement, because Johnson filed a document that he purported to retroactively waive Dennis Perry's habeas rights, without Dennis Perry's knowledge or his consent. This happened on March 10, 2003, 1 month after his conviction. Dennis Perry filed a motion for a new trial, and that same day, John Johnson filed a sentencing statement that memorialized the terms of Dennis Perry's sentencing agreement. In it, Johnson claimed that Dennis had waived his appellate rights and his habeas rights. It said,
the state, after conviction, has waived seeking the death penalty on the condition that the defendant waive and give up all his post-trial motions, including, but not limited, to any of his appeal rights.
This document was signed by John Johnson and by Judge Williams and filed with the court, but it was never signed by Dennis Perry or any of his attorneys. Its claim that Dennis Perry gave up his habeas rights is simply not true. That never happened. The transcript from Dennis Perry's sentencing agreement is clear. The only offer made and the only offer accepted was Dennis Perry's agreement to waive his right to appeal his conviction and sentence. There was no waiver of Dennis Perry's habeas rights. Which means that, just as an example, there was never any waiver of Dennis Perry's right to, say, challenge the constitutionality of a prosecutor's decision to hide the fact that another man confessed to the murders that Dennis Perry is currently serving two life sentences for. In other words, this may be the end of Season 3 of Undisclosed, but this is far from the end of Dennis Perry's case. His attorneys at the Georgia Innocence Project and King & Spalding continue to work on Dennis's behalf, and as this case develops, we'll keep you updated on it every step of the way. And, oh yeah, if and when we ever get the full transcripts from Dennis Perry's trial, we'll do an episode on that too. Next time, eventually, on Undisclosed. And that's all for episode 21 and season 3 of Undisclosed, The State versus Dennis Perry. But don't forget, there's still a final addendum this Thursday. So send us all your questions about season 3 with the hashtag UDAddendum. To all our listeners, thank you so much for listening to this season. And while we don't have dates for you yet, we'll be back again before too long. Methil Telhan is our executive producer, and our logo is designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Our miracle working audio producers for this season have been Rebecca Lavoie and Hannah McCarthy, and our incredible addendum host is John Cryer, who'll be back on Thursday for the final addendum. Huge thanks goes to everyone over at the Georgia Innocence Project, which represents Dennis Perry, Joey Watkins, and many, many other defendants in Georgia and Alabama who have been wrongfully convicted. If you'd like to support their work, please pick up your phones now and text the word Dennis to 91999. You'll get a link right back where you can donate in any amount to help the Georgia Innocence Project continue its work. Special thanks also goes out to Ed Kostikian, who interned at GIP this summer and was fantastic help in the investigation, and also to former GIP attorney Christina Cribbs for her years of work on Dennis's behalf and with her help in the investigation for this podcast. Also, for their work all season, thank you to Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logus, and Skylar Park, who have transcribed every episode of Season 3. You can find the transcripts and other case materials at our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. And thank you to our sponsors. We literally could not be here without you. Oh, and absolutely no thanks goes to my cats, Ragnarok and Ghost, who do everything in their power to actively oppose the production of this podcast. Even though Season 3 is over, our investigation into Dennis Perry's case is not. So here's one final plea to our listeners. Over the past 6 months, I've heard from a lot of people who've contacted the podcast to tell us things like, I don't know anything useful, and I'm sure this isn't helpful to you, but here's this thing I know that I figured I'd pass along just in case. And, like, pretty much always, it's been something that was absolutely helpful, and I was really glad to know. So, to everyone out there in Camden County or anywhere else who thinks they may know something about the case but don't think it's important enough to tell us about, well, you're wrong. I'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or reach me at susan.simpson@gmail.com, or call and leave us a message at 410-205-5563.